This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear.
There's only one country. There's only one structure of power that wields weapons of mass destruction on a planetary scale. That is the United States. If there were inspections in North Dakota of the missile systems that could lay low this planet in a matter of minutes, we'd see where the threat to humanity really lies.
Stratfor is talking about the building of U.S. bases in Iraq, covering Iraq with bases. Now, these bases then would give the U.S. direct hegemony in the Middle East.
Who then is allied with the United States to replace Saddam Hussein? None other than the very butchers of the Iraqi population under the control of Saddam Hussein, their man in Baghdad.
This is Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I'm speaking today with Maya Schoen and Ralph Schoenman, producers of Taking Aim, a public affairs program which airs weekly on KPFA's sister station, WBAI in New York, Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Taking Aim can be heard here in California on the internet at www.wbai.org on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Today, we're talking about Iraq and the administration's efforts to go to war against that country in spite of public opposition domestically and internationally. George W. Bush has said that a decision will be made within weeks, not months. If this war starts, it looks to be devastating beyond all imagination. What is the U.S. government's plan of shock and awe for Iraq? What is the scale of the planned slaughter and the nature of the weaponry?
Bonnie, on February 2nd, the New York Times had an important article by Eric Schmidt and Tom Shanker about the war plan, just what you're talking about, shock and awe. And this followed on the CBS revelation a few days before. Now, what the New York Times stated is that 3,000 precision-guided bombs and missiles would be used against Baghdad alone within the first 48 hours. And the purpose was to destroy the civilian population. And this bombardment is 10 times the number of precision-guided weapons that were used in the first days of the Persian Gulf War, Desert Storm, in 1991. Now, the purpose would be to destroy the water facilities, the communication facilities, and to put the civilian population in such a state of shock and awe to devastate the population. Ralph?
Well, Maya and Bonnie, keep in mind this. The first announcements about the intention to use between 8 and 10 times the amount of cruise missiles in the first 48 hours than were used in the entire 40-day period of the Gulf War was then amplified, and it was upped from 800 cruise missiles to 3,000. Keep in mind that at the time of the Gulf War, the small country of Iraq with 17 million people was attacked with a bombardment of such magnitude that they used more explosive tonnage in that period than in the entire 7 years of World War II in Europe, North Africa, and Asia combined. It is almost impossible to imagine the magnitude of this devastation. If we took a moment to listen to the voice of the Undersecretary of the United Nations, Matti Ahtisaari, at the time of the Gulf War, and the saturation bombing of the main cities of Iraq. He wrote, "Nothing that we had seen or read or could have anticipated prepared us for the particular form of devastation which has befallen this country. The conflict has wrought near apocalyptic results upon the economic infrastructure of what had been, until 1991, a rather highly urbanized and mechanized society. Now, most means of modern life support have been destroyed and rendered tenuous. Iraq has become, for an unpredictable period into the future, a country in a pre-industrial age, with all the disabilities of post-industrial dependency on intensive use of energy and technology." It's difficult to convey what this means. All civilian communications were destroyed. Transportation for the population was obliterated. Roads, bridges, tunnels, Iraq was dependent upon imported food, all of that was reduced to rubble. Their refineries were reduced to rubble. The grain and food sheds, the warehouses were targeted and destroyed. There were no more foodstuffs to distribute. The same was true of medicines, pharmaceutical products, bandages, antibiotics, hospital supplies, surgical equipment, equipment for blood typing, blood supplies, anesthesia, means of sterilization. The water system was deliberately targeted. Potable water was eliminated. That's in the last round. Now they are talking about a magnitude of many, many elements beyond what was done at the time of the Gulf War. It is a genocide announced in advance that is being prepared for the people of Iraq.
The notion of shock and awe, Bonnie, comes from Sun Tzu, The Art of War. And the idea is just what you would imagine. Shock and awe is supposed to be intended towards the civilian population so that there will be no resistance. What people don't realize is that the U.S. has actually been bombarding Iraq since March, what was called the pea soup of deception by the Israeli intelligence magazine Debka. And what they meant by pea soup of deception is that people thought that there was all this negotiations through the United Nations and with the European states and also with Arab states such as Saudi Arabia. But in fact, the military plans for the invasion had started in March, and that special forces were already in the northern part of Iraq, and there was training going on with the Turkish troops and also with elements of the Kurdish people done by U.S. Special Forces. And what has happened since March with this nonstop bombardment is that the Iraqi military defenses have been destroyed, including the fiber optic systems that had been built by the Chinese.
Maya, it's 250,000 airstrikes that have continually been inflicted upon the Iraqi population in the past decade. 250,000. It has been continuous bombardment, continuous destruction of the infrastructure of that society, what little is there to be destroyed. Every time they make a tentative attempt to restore basic infrastructure, they attack it again. There is a design in this which is very clear. Iraq has been at the center of the Arab anti-colonial revolution and has been targeted for devastation precisely for that reason. The peoples of the Arab East are the people who have been specifically victimized in relation to that resource that happens to be in their area, namely oil. But the objective of American imperialism is to inflict so ghastly a price in human suffering that the population will become atomized and will lose the capacity to resist.
Now, one of the reasons I think that the Pentagon has moved towards this shock and awe strategy is that the military analysts were contemplating that there would be massive resistance when U.S. troops were having to enter Baghdad. And there had been very extensive articles in both the Wall Street Journal and in the New York Times about the implications of block to block, house to house, and the expectation that there would be 30,000 U.S. casualties when U.S. troops had to go into Baghdad in order to occupy, because while the United States is the most highly developed military in the world, when it comes to block to block, house to house, and hand to hand combat, all this night vision equipment and precision guided missiles and stuff doesn't cut it. And so consequently, the intention was destroy the population of Iraq.
So in order to avoid any casualties at all, the United States government is proposing to devastate a country that's already devastated.
Well, let's look at that carefully, Bonnie, because the American ruling class has always used our working population as cannon fodder in pursuit of these wars. In the Gulf War itself, out of 560,000 United States troops, over 200,000 of these soldiers have been affected by the depleted uranium and the biological weapons that the U.S. government unleashed upon Iraq itself. 200,000 Gulf veterans. If you go to the Gulf veterans website, you'll see the lawsuits and the testimonies and the overwhelming massive evidence of the effects of depleted uranium on the soldiers, not just the Iraqi population, which we can discuss in a moment, but the U.S. Gulf War veterans themselves are suffering from neurological collapse, from the compromise of their kidneys, from endemic and systemic disease. U.S. soldiers have always functioned as cannon fodder for these imperial wars, and I think we really have to put this in a very particular context about how power is structured in our society. Maya and I, in taking aim, have been over the course of our programming discussing the data of the U.S. Department of Commerce to the effect that 2% of the population owns and controls 90% of the national wealth. Well, the most recent data, just recently published, demonstrates that that has now increased in terms of the concentration of power by another 100%. It's 1% of the population that has amassed and controls 95% of the national wealth in this society. Keeping in mind that inside our frontiers in this country, we have about 5% of the world's population. So 1% of 5% of the world's population not only commands 95% of the national wealth, but presides over 70% of the world's natural resources. By any criterion, by any standard, that is an empire, that is an imperium, that is an imperial system that is addicted to war as an addict needs his fix and in ever-increasing doses to preserve this capitalist system of rule, based upon exploitation of labor and the usurpation of the resources of peoples across the planet. They need permanent war. And they cannot sell that to our people without terrorizing our people with pretexts, with fabricated threats to the population of the United States. Let's just take a moment to look at this little country, Iraq. 1/17 the GDP of Turkey. 1/10 that of Saudi Arabia. 1/3 the GDP of little Kuwait, that artificial construct amputated from Iraq as its southern province. Iraq is a devastated society. It is an impoverished society. It is a country of 21 million people whose rural population lives on 30 cents a day. It is a country whose infrastructure was totally laid low in the Gulf War. It is a people that is suffering from endemic disease because the depleted uranium and the biological agents that were inflicted throughout Iraq by American imperialism, by U.S. imperialism, have resulted in an epidemic of thalidomide-like deformities, birth deformities, children across Iraq being born with two heads and no hearts and stumpy arms. It is a crisis of unimaginable proportions in terms of the health, basic health of the civilian population. And when we add that to the ruthless sanctions, which by admission of the United Nations that administers this war crime, these sanctions have cost the lives of 1.5 million civilians, 750,000 children in Iraq. And the most recent reports that have been published establish that 13 million children in Iraq are now at risk with the onset of the coming war. It is a tiny country, a devastated country, an impoverished country, a country without any capacity to defend itself, let alone to be a putative threat to anyone else. There is only one country, there is only one structure of power that wields weapons of mass destruction on a planetary scale. That is the United States. If there were inspections in North Dakota of the missile systems that could lay low this planet in a matter of minutes, we'd see where the threat to humanity really lies. The entire predicate of inspections of this charade called the United Nations of this devastated land bespeaks the ideology of imperialism and nothing else. We cannot buy into it. We cannot allow ourselves to be suckered into debating the tactics of an imperial rationale when our own people are no less targeted than are the people of Iraq.
Yes, Ralph, and of course, why are they going into Iraq then? And that brings us to the question of oil and also Iraq's strategic place within the Middle East, because Baghdad is only 620 miles from the Prince Sultan Air Base, which is 60 miles south of the capital of Saudi Arabia. And it's also within that distance from most of the countries in the Middle East, which is just minor striking distance. And as people are well aware by now, Iraq has a known reserves of 112 billion barrels of crude oil, second only to Saudi Arabia, in terms of the ease of getting the oil. This is known reserves, and it's expected that Iraq probably has, in the unexplored parts of Iraq, twice that much. And it's been calculated. It's a very simple calculation if you look at how much oil is used in the United States each day, that Iraq alone could supply the United States for 100 years.
Well, that's without the Western Desert Reserves, as you mentioned, Maya. Right. And literally, since 1964, Bonnie, every U.S. administration has had preparations for direct seizure of Arab oil. There has been no single administration since 1964 that has not had developed plans in the National Security Council to seize Arab oil. Robert Tucker was describing the feasibility of direct military securing of Arab oil fields through American military intervention in commentary in January 1975 when he was leaking Pentagon plans of that time. Oil, the issue of American intervention, he wrote, without intervention, there is a distinct possibility of an economic and political disaster in the United States, bearing more than a superficial resemblance to that disaster of the 1930s. And he described the area for American seizure, U.S. military seizure, as, quote, the Arab shoreline of the Gulf, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. And the conquistador were already well prepared in each administration for the military seizure of this oil. Again, this was orchestrated by Myles Ignatius, who is in fact a Defense Intelligence Agency figure, and whose real name is Edward Luttwak, in an article that was then published in Harper's Magazine called Seizing Arab Oil. And Ignatius wrote at that time, we have developed a rapid deployment and strike scenario. The 82nd Airborne Division, strengthened by air cavalry battalions, will embark on giant C-5 and C-141 jet transports, refuel at Israeli bases, proceed to drop paratroops at key Saudi oil fields, escorted by phantom fighters based on Israeli fields and carriers in the Arabian Sea. Within 72 hours, we will have secured these regions and taken control of the oil. And this is the top-secret Department of Defense plan that was revealed in the London Sunday Times on February 9, 1975. Quote, codename Dahran Option 4. The plan has been drawn up by the Pentagon for a U.S. attack on the oil fields containing 40% of the world's known reserves. And in August 1975, oil fields as a strategic military objective, published jointly by Colonel John Collins, the senior specialist in national defense for the Pentagon, and presented to the House Committee on International Relations, every single administration. This, then, has been on the drawing board, and not just on the drawing board, but have been operational plans for the National Security Council from 1964 on and intensified during the mid-1970s. It's been all prepared. And in 1979, the Pentagon analyst Lawrence Mosher revealed a plan which was circulating in the Pentagon and in Washington corridors. Quote, what military people call the U.S. 100,000-man quick strike force consisting of multiple divisions rapidly deployable will be put into play. But, he said, Pentagon officials have stated we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can sell the public the idea of our rapid strike force. Of course, that boogeyman may not be defined the same in Arabic as in English, he wrote. Listen to this carefully, please. You have in the ruling councils of the United States the design for the seizure of the oil of the region, the discarding of the pass-through comprador regimes imposed and inflicted and installed by American imperialism, and the direct military seizure of the entire region and its oil resources, and then the problem they have is selling this to the American people. How do you provide the rationale? How do you whipsaw people into a numbed acquiescence into a prearranged military plan? The category of terror.
I'm speaking with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen of Taking Aim. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What is the category of terror?
It's a contrivance, Bonnie. As the prior rationale for American imperial designs, namely that of the specter of communism and of the Soviet Union, was no longer available to them as the Soviet Union was collapsing and the Cold War rationale could no longer provide a justification for the mammoth expenditure on arms and the preparation for permanent war ad seriatim, they devised, by conscious design, the contrivance of the category of terror. And this, by the way, was something that was worked out through a series of meetings in the National Security Council, and prominent in these discussions were people whose names are coming to light now, people like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, Benjamin Netanyahu.
And Gene Kirkpatrick.
Gene Kirkpatrick. Netanyahu, by the way.
Former UN ambassador.
And a subsequent prime minister of Israel. Netanyahu has been disclosed in the Israeli press at the time. He was a high-level CIA spook. He had four names, actually, and four passports and four identities, one of which was John L. Sullivan. In other words, it was John Sullivan. And Netanyahu, along with elements of the Committee on the Present Danger and the American Enterprise Institute and the very people now who are running policy for Bush, were contriving the category of terror as a pretext for military expenditure and a substitute for the Soviet Union as the justification for vast military outlay and for forward imperial design. There was a major conference in Tel Aviv at the time. George Bush Sr. was there. George Shultz was there. The young Netanyahu was one of the principal organizers of this conference. The Perls and the Wolfowitz and the Armitages were all in place. You know, not very long ago, the New York Times ran a cover story in its magazine, Sunday Magazine, called The Sunshine Warrior, which was about Paul Wolfowitz, the Undersecretary of Defense, Deputy Director. And it opens by citing a high-level meeting of the American military with Wolfowitz, the keynote speaker, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Paul Shinseki, opens by saying that Paul Wolfowitz has been making these arrangements and these plans since the 1970s, as the New York Times said, with almost a drum roll. It was Wolfowitz, he said, who had designed the strategy of a war against terror. It was in the councils of the National Security Council. It was with the consultation of JINSA, which is something that was recently discussed in The Nation, which is really a Mossad and Zionist design for the category of terror as the leitmotif for imperial policy on the part of the United States and its surrogate Israel in the Middle East. And frankly, it really is but a little continuation of something that we wrote about in The Hidden History of Zionism, namely the plan of Oded Yinon, who was a Mossad operative, who lay forth a stratagem called the Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, which called for the fragmentation of each Arab country in its turn into its ethnic and religious components as they were at the time of the Ottoman Empire.
When you talk about the strategy of terror, are you referring also to staged terrorist attacks worldwide?
Well, first of all, the category of terror, which earmarks presumptive groups that are threatening the security, has to do with those very groups that were funded and created by the intelligence agencies themselves, just as Abu Nidal was a creation of the Israeli Mossad, so Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and these folks emerge out of Central Intelligence Agency operations. $6 billion, after all, set up Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar at the time of the contrivance in Afghanistan. I say contrivance because, as you have discussed and we on our own show have talked about, Zbigniew Brzezinski in the Grand Chess Game has detailed the setting up of this apparatus in Afghanistan, not as a response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but rather as a vehicle for inducing that response. Prior to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, these terrorist apparatuses were funded and created and set into play and actually put into motion in the Central Asian republics of the former Soviet Union to bait the bear, as Brzezinski described it, and to draw the Soviet Union into Afghanistan. But the fundamental point being here that there is no such so-called terrorist group, none, that does not have its genesis in a false flag operation, namely a U.S. intelligence apparatus, Israeli Mossad apparatus plan to serve a particular objective in Paris. They're all monitored, they're all penetrated, they're all operated, they're all run by U.S. imperialism. And concretely, if you want to draw this forward to the question of the World Trade Center, let's take a look at 1993, the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, which, after all, has been deployed as the rationale by the then Clinton administration for preparing for military intervention across Central Asia. That was the opening note of this plan for $5 trillion of short-term profit. Well, the World Trade Center in 1993, amplifying this whole notion of the category of terror, had a very different scenario than the official fiction with which we are bombarded. Because there was a particular operative, Imad Ali Salem, who was the putative organizer of that event. And Imad Ali Salem turns out to have been not only a high-level operative of Egyptian intelligence, but also an FBI operative in direct relationship to the FBI office in New York. This man was sent into the mosque of the Egyptian cleric in New Jersey. And I should mention that the Egyptian cleric, the blind cleric, was himself a former Central Intelligence Agency operative who had been part of what was called Operation Cyclone in Egypt. Now, Operation Cyclone was part of the, quote, terror apparatus, unquote, that took the life of Anwar Sadat, the assassination of Anwar Sadat. That was a CIA-funded operation. Subsequent to that, we have Imad Ali Salem approaching the mosque, recruiting young men on a need-to-know basis, and proposing to them a series of provocative adventures, blowing up the World Trade Center, blowing up the Lincoln Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, the Statue of Liberty, the United Nations building. To every one of these meetings, this man wore a wire. He brought the funds. He brought the operational plan. He set up the meetings. He organized the discussions. And he made a transcript of the wire with which he recorded every word that was uttered during those discussions that he himself prepared. And he then delivered the transcripts into the offices of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in New York for 6 months prior to the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. 50 file boxes of the entire apparatus that was being put into motion and planned by Imad Ali Salem. And then we find that the very individual who organized the apartment, who arranged the Ryder rental van that carried the explosives, turns out to be someone named Guzi Hadass, a notorious Mossad operative. And the Israeli intelligence services had already broadcast into their internal services the details of the World Trade Center attack of 1993. This has been documented in the Village Voice, in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times. I wrote about it myself at the time in World Who Are the Real Terrorists? The Hand of the FBI in the Blowing Up of the World Trade Center in 1993. This is what we mean by false flag operation and the construct of terror as the new rationale for imperialism. How else do you terrorize the American people into acquiescence in these plans? One other point about this. I think that many of our listeners are aware of something called Operation Northwoods in 1962. When in the councils of the National Security Council, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer, devised the following plan. And keep in mind that this was not some wet dream of a marginal figure. The chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff submitted this to all members of the Joint Chiefs, and each of them signed off on it individually. It was then devised and developed and prepared formally in the National Security Council, and it called for the hijacking of airplanes, flying them into buildings and civilian centers in the United States. It called for the assassination of citizens in Miami, Florida, Atlanta, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. It prepared for the blowing up of the rocket ship carrying astronaut John Glenn. And all of this disaster was to be imputed to who? Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution. To create the pretext and provide the rationale for a hysterical response on the part of our people, to provide the justification for an instant invasion of Cuba and the overthrow of the government of Fidel Castro. By the way, the plan went up to Robert McNamara, and McNamara presented it to John F. Kennedy. The Kennedy brothers considered it seriously and came back with a request for some alternatives because they thought that the hand of the U.S. would be too obvious to these arrangements, and they didn't sign off on this plan for which the Joint Chiefs were ready to go. And the Kennedy assassination followed not that long afterwards. We have here a very clear demonstration of the way American imperialism operates, the structure of power that it commands, what it needs on a world scale, and how it deploys events to create for our people a pretext for things long on the drawing board, operational and ready to go. And that's the category of terror's role in the permanent war that we see before us now. That's the meaning of 9/11. And there's a whole discussion to be had on the precise scenario of Operation Northwoods and the World Trade Center 93 being played out, full documentation of the hands of intelligence all over this operation. This is our ruling class. This is a decadent system that requires permanent war and permanent repression and an ever-deteriorating condition of life for the mass of our people in this country and without.
Ralph and Maya, speaking of the category of terror, you both have referred to Saddam Hussein as our man in Baghdad. What do you mean by that?
We have to remember that the people of Iraq were under the heel of someone who is known as the Stooge of Baghdad, namely Nuri as-Said, who was a British intelligence agent and who was in control of the young King Faisal II. And by the way, Faisal II was the son of King Razi, who had been assassinated by British agents, and that's a long discussion, but it has to do with the amputation of Kuwait, which was the southernmost province of Iraq, when British imperialism simply took it as an oil-producing area and as a staging ground, not only on Mesopotamia, but their designs on the Indian Empire, or their empire in India, I should say. Now, Saddam Hussein, at the time of the overthrow of the government of Nuri as-Said and the subsequent killing of Nuri as-Said and of King Faisal II with a spontaneous and generalized uprising of the Iraqi people in 1958. Saddam Hussein was an asset of the Central Intelligence Agency at the time. The young political and military officer who came into power at that time was Abdul Karim Qasim. I had the opportunity to have extended talks with him and his foreign minister, Hashim Jawad, in 1962 in Baghdad. And in those days, what had happened was that the generalized uprising against the colonial-sponsored regime in Baghdad led to the legalization of the Communist Party and the nationalist parties of Iraq. Yes, ma'am.
And more so, what it did is there were all these oil concessions in Iraq, by particularly the British, and there was a consortium of imperial countries that, with the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, had very large concessions in Saudi Arabia, which is really the Arabia of the House of Saud, and then in Iraq, the Iraqi Petroleum Company. And these concessions were stealing the oil of Arabia and of Iraq. So with the upsurge of the population, what Abdul Karim Qasim was forced to do was to limit the concessions to a very tiny percentage.
0.1% of the area of Iraq, effectively the regaining of control over the oil resources of the country for the government of Iraq and for its population immediately. Saddam Hussein was set in motion as a CIA asset. He was a young right-wing member and leader of the Ba'ath Party at the time, and he was run out of Baghdad by the CIA station chief. It's all described with meticulous documentation in the book Ropes of Sand by Wilbur Eveland and subsequent articles at the time by Jack Anderson and such. Saddam Hussein was their man or our man in Baghdad. He made three attempts on the life of Abdulkarim Qasim at the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency. He succeeded in murdering Abdulkarim Qasim, finally. And with that, the Arif regime was installed, and Saddam Hussein was put in charge of the Palace of the Doomed, the torture chamber of Iraq, which were under the direct control of the Central Intelligence Agency. An entire generation was wiped out. Tribal leaders, village leaders, trade union leaders, students, intelligentsia, everybody associated with the national aspirations of the Iraqi people was subject to torture and murder and disappearances. Hundreds of thousands of people died. We organized at the time an international conference about it in London. Saddam Hussein was the torturer of the Central Intelligence Agency in Iraq. And the irony of it all is that every prior regime, even those under the control of the British in Iraq, had demanded the recovery of their southernmost province of Kuwait. And in Kuwait itself, the Free Kuwaiti Movement, which galvanized the students in Kuwait, demanded reunification with Iraq, the mother country. It was Saddam Hussein who first acknowledged and accepted the nominal independence of this, what has been described as a family oil company with a seat in the United Nations, the regime of the 200-person feudal family, Asaba, in Kuwait. They had about $2.8 trillion in U.S. and European banks, just flight capital.
What is the motivation? What is the driving force behind this new war that we're looking at that may even start in the next few weeks?
Bonnie, the intention with the occupation of Iraq, and this is a military occupation of long standing, such as the U.S. had in Japan after World War II, or if you look at the Balkans, what the U.S. and the NATO forces, they broke up Yugoslavia, and they are occupying Yugoslavia. And so this is the plan for Iraq, and it's already been announced that General Tommy Franks, the head of the U.S. Central Command, who is in charge of the military operations for Iraq, he would be the military commander in Iraq. And although they say the occupation would be for a year and a half, everyone knows that it's going to be long-standing for 10 or even more years. Now, what Stratfor, a U.S. military intelligence analyst operation, which is available on the Internet, Stratfor is talking about the building of U.S. bases in Iraq, covering Iraq with bases. Now, these bases then would give the U.S. direct hegemony in the Middle East, because if you look at the countries that border Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Syria, the U.S. would be within a few hundred miles of striking distance from Iraq into each of these countries. And when they talk about democracy, is what Ralph was saying, you have to look at the people that the U.S. has been working with. For instance, General Nizar al-Khwarizmi, who was the most senior military officer to defect since 1990. Now, he was Saddam Hussein's chief of staff from 1980 until 1991. He led the Iraqi army during the eight-year Iran-Iraq war and also the invasion of Kuwait in 1990, the invasion of Kuwait that was inspired by the United States. And
used as the pretext for everything that follows. And here's the very figure, the military figure under their control who carries out the operation, and he is their point man for control of Iraq after they depose Saddam
Hussein. And it goes even further when you look at the so-called mythology about weapons of mass destruction and the most intense mythology, which is that Saddam Hussein ordered the use of chemical weapons against his own people, the Kurdish people of Halabja, in March 1988.
General Nizar al-Khwarizmi
okay.
was their man under Saddam Hussein, who poisoned and burned 5,000 Kurdish civilians in Halabja itself. Ironically enough, as Stephen Pelletier of the Defense Intelligence Agency has disclosed, this assault upon the Kurdish population with U.S.-supplied weapons did not include cyanide gas, as the U.S. now deploys as a rationale for attacking Iraq. The Defense Intelligence Agency analysis at the time documented that it was Iranian forces that used this particular weapon and that affected the Kurds in Halabja. And ironically, the Mossad and the Israelis were suppliers to Iran at the time, including these elements of gas. So you really get a feel for what we have here. These impoverished countries, these with their surrogate regimes, receive their weapons of mass destruction to use on their own populations from their masters in Washington and Tel Aviv.
And as far as democracy goes, if it's not the general, they also have another general waiting in the wings, and that's Brigadier General Najib al-Salihi. And who is he? He was the commander of the armored divisions of the Republican Guard. The Republican Guard are the elite of the Iraqi army. And he was the commander in the Gulf War. But not only that, when there was a U.S.-inspired uprising of the Shiites in the south and of the Kurds in the north, he was the man who suppressed the uprising. If you remember, the CIA inspired this uprising, but then President Clinton refused to provide the backup. And consequently, Saddam Hussein was able to suppress this.
I'm speaking with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen of Taking Aim. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, you're talking about people that are part of the so-called Iraqi opposition that the U.S. administration is going to support.
Well, actually,
is that right?
It's not that you're just part of it. These are the people who have been specified by the CIA and the Pentagon to become the leaders of Iraq in a so-called democratic Iraq. Who is it they're turning to? And, of course, the one who's most often in the press is Ahmed al-Shalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress, which was the umbrella organization created by the CIA in 1992. And in Jordan, where he had fled after he left Iraq and he set up the Petra Bank, he escaped Jordan in order to not stand trial because there was a total thievery of this bank, such that he was tried in absentia and he was sentenced to 32 years in prison.
In short, what we're looking at here is this. These generals in the army of Saddam Hussein, instruments of American policy of the period of the overthrow of Abdul Karim Qasim, the oppressors of their own people, were demonized by the United States when it wanted a pretext for invading Iraq. But then what they did was they wanted, because this is, a rather critical point, they hold up Saddam Hussein now as the demon, yes? But the instruments of rule, the brutal instruments of rule, they intend to retain. So the leaders of the presumptive opposition, the Iraqi National Congress opposition to Saddam Hussein, funded and sponsored by the Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency, are none other than who? General Nizar al-Khazraji, who is involved in the attack on the Kurds, and who was described by United States senior official in the State Department, David Mack, who coordinates the Iraqi opposition in Washington, D.C. He says General Nizar al-Khazraji not only has a good military reputation, he is the right ingredients as our future leader of Iraq. And as Meyer was describing, Khazraji's role was choosing the chemicals supplied by the United States to use on the population in Iraq. And why were they being used on that population? Because the Kurds and the Shiites and the population in Iraq aspired to replace the regime of Saddam Hussein with a government that they had some say in controlling and that would preside over their control over their natural resources. Does the United States want a democratic outcome in Iraq? Not by the life of Abdul Karim Qasim, they don't. Not by the extermination of the resistors to the suppression of the Iraqi National Revolution, they do not. Who then is allied with the United States to replace Saddam Hussein? None other than the very butchers of the Iraqi population under the control of Saddam Hussein, their man in Baghdad. They want to take out Saddam Hussein. They want to keep in place the instruments of repression and of terrorizing the Iraqi people. And that includes Brigadier General Najib al-Salahi. And as Maya was describing, not only was he the vehicle for suppressing the Shiite population, and not for a moment should we think that the U.S. imperialists have any sympathy for the Shiite population of Iraq, the invasion of Iran was precisely because the Shiite population of southern Iraq and of the Gulf Emirates were inspired by the Iranian Revolution and were threatening these rotten, corrupt regimes in the Gulf Emirates. That's why they sent Iraqi soldiers into Iran. So what do they do now with respect to the desires of the Shiite population in the south of Iraq? The United States gives support to the suppression by Saddam Hussein through Brigadier General Najib al-Salahi, who now, along with Khazraji, is the point man for U.S. policy in Iraq, in a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq, the very figures of the repression. He was the head of the Republican Guard. He was the significant commander in the Iraqi mobilization on the borders of Kuwait. And the repressive way in which he handled the suppression of the Shiite rebellion in the south, 1.5 million people had to flee their homes. And he then wrote a book about his crushing of the Shiite uprising entitled Al-Zilzal, the earthquake. This is all described, by the way, in a very telling article in the Glasgow Sunday Herald on September 22, 2002, the headline of which is Unveiled, the Thugs Bush Wants in Place of Saddam. Nothing so clearly illuminates what imperialism does to the peoples of the world and how they manipulate public opinion, how they deploy their own creation, figures like Saddam Hussein or Noriega or who have you, their people. And that includes the Osama bin Ladens and the Al-Qaedas who were funded and created and put into play by the Central Intelligence Agency and then hung out to dry as the demons. You know, talk about conspiracy theory. Here you've got this 200-person apparatus, originally funded by Central Intelligence, 200-person apparatus, more powerful than 50,000 hydrogen bomb-bearing missiles, more menacing than the Soviet Union. It's Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan. Everywhere and nowhere, an orange alert tomorrow, poisoning the food supply today, anthrax epidemics inflicted on the United States from this man who can't break wind, the Central Intelligence Agency disclosed, without it being recorded on the spy satellites of American imperialism. This is a system of misrule, of misdirection, of deception, weapons of mass distraction to create the conditions for an unchallenged American imperium. And that's what's at stake in Iraq, and that's what's at stake with the next target in Iran, and that's what's at stake with the carving up of that region, and that's what's at stake in Southeast Asia, and that's what's at stake with the repression that will be brought down upon the American people to prevent us from disclosing and opposing and mobilizing against this economic and political system of capitalist rule in the United States.
Is this new war simply the first volley in a continuous war? The administration keeps talking about a 30-year war, a war that will not end in our lifetimes, a 100-year war. Well, obviously, if they do, in fact, go ahead and attack Iraq, install some new despots, occupy the country, what is next? That's not going to take them 30 years.
It's a permanent war. It's a permanent war against the peoples of the United States as well as the peoples of the world. And already they're talking about North Korea as well. It's quite clear that Iran is also on the drawing board. And he's already told Saudi Arabia that Saudi Arabia is a target. And you can go country by country through the United Nations. Any country that is in disagreement with the policies of the U.S. corporations. So what you see taking place now is the beginning of what we call the permanent war. They can only do this with the acquiescence of the people of the United States. And that is why the growth of the anti-war movement at such a large scale so quickly is so important. And the involvement of trade unions. What you had originally was, for instance, SEIU, one of the largest trade unions in the country representing service workers and healthcare workers. The international itself wasn't ready to take a position. It said that politics was not the role of the union, even though the unions fund the Democratic Party continuously, and you couldn't elect a Democratic Party politician without the phone banking and the efforts of the trade unions. But what you had happening throughout the United States is that the SEIU locals, such as Local 250 here in the Bay Area, or Local 660 in Los Angeles, passing very strong resolutions against the war. And this led the international to take a position, to write to President Bush and to make statements that having a war was not in the interest of working people. And this is taking place throughout the United States. You also have cities throughout the United States passing resolutions against the war and also against the Patriot Act. There are over 72 cities that have passed resolutions saying that they will not comply with what they consider attacks on the civil liberties of the people in the United States. Because in order to go to war, one of the things they have to do is to suppress our speech, our freedom of assembly, such as what was taking place in New York, where the mayor has refused to give a permit for the anti-war march. Ralph?
One of the consequences of the decaying and degenerating capitalist economy on a global scale is the assault upon the gains of workers of the past century. Healthcare, retirement funds, pensions, the eight-hour day are rapidly becoming a thing of the past. All of the things for which working people struggled and fought over the past century are on the drawing board for elimination today. The states and the counties and the cities are being starved of funds. The tax breaks for the rich are escalating on a scale that has never occurred before. The glut of funds that go into the military results in deficit financing that is cannibalizing the basic infrastructure of our society. Working people, for the most part, resist this and resent it. That's why almost 84% of the population, as the New York Times has documented, actually reject the two political parties, the one big party of capital. They reject it by not registering to vote, and when they register to vote, by not turning out. So you have 48% in a national election of the registered voters, which is a fraction of the eligible electorate. Because for working people, they look at these politicians and they say they're all crooks, they all lie to us, no matter what happens, it's the same old, same old. This disaffection, this anger, this reaction to the assault, the class war that's waged now on working people in the United States is an inexorable outcome of the dependence of capitalism on permanent war budgets, on a deficit-financed economy that destroys the reforms that were themselves a concession to mass mobilizations of the past. That's why there's a Patriot Act. That's why there's this faked terror threat to the people of the United States that is really the authorship of the ruling class itself. It's treason at the top. And as Maya's described, city after city in this country and union after union are opting out. The rank and file are miles ahead of the trade union bureaucrats who have been in bed with the Democratic Party. They don't respond. They don't vote. Fractions of them answer to that command because they're sick of the whole thing. They smell the rottenness of this order which oppresses them. Our movement, this mass movement against the war, is the little beginning of a movement against capitalist control itself in this society, because this system cannot meet the most elementary needs of people on this planet. The consequence of this system is not just mass murder, but epidemic disease, growing starvation, generalized poverty across the planet. And our people in this country will not be immune to those consequences. And as our rights are removed, and as our liberties are threatened, this people will rise up. We are not a rabble. We are an organized presence. And we have, the working people in the United States have never suffered a generalized defeat in this country. They have not yet spoken. It is a sleeping giant. Their bureaucratic leaders have misspoken and misled, but no longer can they count upon the acquiescence of our people in this rotten system. And as the anti-war movement mobilizes people, and as the resistance to the attacks on our living standards grows and spreads and mounts, we will see the conditions for a political challenge to corporate capitalism. That's what these rulers fear. That's why all this exercise of tyrannical power is an expression of their weakness and of their desperation. Once you remove the facade of democratic rule, once their real power is exposed, once their tyrannical and brutal and relentless and exploitative rule is before the eyes of everybody in this society, they are in desperate danger, because there are a handful of people, and we are the many and they are the few. We are beginning the process of a disaffection of our people on a huge scale, and an organized struggle that can only end in a revolutionary transformation of the society. That's our task. It's our responsibility through programs such as Guns and Butter to speak truth to power and to arm people with the political ammunition and with the information they need to send them into political battle well prepared. We have to be prepared for it. We have to speak truth to power. We have to expose the lies of 9/11 in those false flag operations and show the treason at the top, so our people are ready to do what is necessary to take power in their own name and to throw these criminals and these murderers into the dustbin of history where they belong.
Thank you, Ralph and Maya.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear.
I've been speaking with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, producers of WBAI's Taking Aim, a weekly public affairs program on Tuesdays at 5 p.m. in New York, 2 p.m. on the Internet here in California at www.wbai.org. Taking Aim can be contacted by email at takingaim@pacbell.net or call 707-552-9995. That's 707-552-9995. Ralph and Maya will have a table at the anti-war rally, as will Yarrow and I, this coming Sunday, February 16th, in Civic Center Plaza in San Francisco, and we all look forward to meeting you. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Yarrow Mako and me, Bonnie Faulkner. Our engineer is Omar Flamenco. To leave comments or obtain copies of the show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628, or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, cause love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call for all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your light. You know what I'm saying? Look within inside yourself for peace. Give thanks. Live life. And release. You dig me? You got me?
I'm Greg McVicker, host of Earth Songs, inviting you to a benefit for Global Exchange and KPFA Free Speech Radio. It's an evening with outspoken scholar activist Ward Churchill. Kitwa Cherokee, and author of Agents of Repression and Fantasies of the Master Race.